On March the 6th, 1836, while the dead of the Alamo defenders were being prepared to be transformed by fire to ash and bone, the convention at Washington on the Brazos that had declared independence from Mexico gave Sam Houston the formal orders for him to take command as commander-in-chief of the Texan army. And at once, Houston set out for Gonzales, where volunteers were gathering to answer the call of Travis and Houston and Governor Smith to go aid the Alamo. Fannin and the men of his command were still at Goliad. Travis had repeatedly sent express couriers to Fannin to hastily speed to Bear to reinforce the Texians at the Alamo. Travis, in his March 3rd letter appealing for assistance, correctly summarized the situation. Colonel Fannin is said to be on the march to this place with reinforcements, but I fear it is not true, as I have repeatedly sent to him for aid without receiving any. Colonel Bonham, my special messenger, arrived at La Bahia 14 days ago with the request for aid, and on the arrival of the enemy in Bear 10 days ago, I sent an express to Colonel Fannin, which arrived in Goliad on the next day, urging him to send us reinforcements. None have yet arrived. I look to the colonies alone for aid. Unless it arrives soon, I shall have to fight the enemy on his own terms. Travis had been correct. Fannin was not going to arrive, and Travis and his men would face the terms of Santa Anna and his blood-red flag that promised no quarter. James W. Fannin, the commander of the Texian soldiers at Presidio La Bahia, had received the call for help, and he had started to travel to Bear to aid the besieged Alamo defenders on February 26th, but turned back on February 27th and returned to Goliad, where he also wrote a letter. Goliad, February 28th, 1836. Mr. Joseph Mims. The news I gave you a few days back is too true. The enemy have the town of Bear with a large force, and I fear we'll have our brave countrymen in the Alamo. Another force is near me. It crossed the Oasis yesterday morning and attacked a party by surprise under Colonel Johnson and routed them, killing Captain Pearson and several others after they had surrendered. I have about 420 men here, and if I can get provisions in tomorrow or next day, can maintain myself against any force. I will never give up the ship while there is a pea in the ditch. If I am whipped, it will be well done, and you may never expect to see me. I hope to see all Texans in arms soon. If not, we shall lose our homes and must go east of the Trinity for a while. Look to our property, save it for my family. If my family arrives, send my wife this letter. Hoping for the best and prepared for the worst. Farewell, J.W. Fannin, Jr. Fannin is an interesting character among the many interesting characters of Texas history. In March 1836, he was 32 years old and a native of Georgia, having been born in 1804 to an unwed mother and Dr. Isham Fannin. He grew up on the plantation of his maternal grandfather, James W. Walker, and studied for some time at the United States Military Academy at West Point under the name of James F. Walker from 1819 to 1821, leaving for unknown reasons without graduating. He had never been the best, but he had never been the worst in the academy. And later he married Minerva Fort in Georgia, and they had two daughters. And in the fall of 1834, he came to Texas as James W. Fannin and settled at Velasco. He had a plantation, and he traded in slaves, and he became involved in the political unrest of the day. In August 1835, he wrote a friend in the United States with the goal of gaining financial help to support the Texians' cause and to help rally West Point graduates to lead the Texian army. He fought at the Battle of Gonzales in October 1835, and with James Bowie, he had scouted for the advance of the army on Bear that ultimately resulted in the battle to take it that was led by old Ben Milam. He had led the Texans at the Battle of Concepcion in November, and Sam Houston gave Fannin a commission as a colonel in December, and he became involved in seeking reinforcements and war supplies for the army. In January 1836, he had been busy seeking volunteers for a campaign in Matamoros, and this leads him to Goliad. On February 7th, Fannin was elected colonel of the Provisional Regiment of Volunteers at Goliad on February 7th. And from February 12th to March 12th, he acted as commander-in-chief of the army. News that General Urrea had occupied Matamoros convinced him that he needed to gather men together and strengthen the defenses of Goliad, which is where he was when Santa Anna and his army arrived at Bear and laid siege to the Alamo. Goliad had a long history, and its name was tied directly to the cause of Mexican independence. It began as Santa Dorotea, and then with the arrival of Mission Espiritu Santo and Presidio La Bahia in the mid-1700s, the settlement of La Bahia on the San Antonio River started growing. And in 1829, not long before the Texas Revolution, a resident of La Bahia had petitioned that the settlement be renamed in honor of Miguel Hidalgo y Costilla, the man who had cried out for Mexican independence in 1810 and launched the revolution that ultimately resulted in that outcome of freedom from Spain. A decree issued on February the 4th, 1829, officially changed the name from La Bahia to Villa de Goliad, which is an anagram of Hidalgo without the H. One of Mexico's most famous generals, Ignacio Seguin Zaragoza, was born there the next month, and he apparently could have been there as a child in Goliad when Fannin found himself there in March 1836. Houston arrived at Gonzales on March 11th. He found at least 300 volunteers gathered there to go to aid Travis and his men. The first news of the Alamo's fall also arrived at Gonzales on that day as well. Many women of Gonzales were learning that they were now widows. Santa Anna was in Bear thinking the war was won. Remember that he had been a young officer serving under his mentor Arredondo in 1813. After the bloody victory at the Battle of Medina, Arredondo had exacted punishment on Texas. The Alamo was Santa Anna's Medina. All that remained was to send his forces throughout the settlements to assert authority and exact further punishment. Houston sent a dispatch that day to Fannin. To Colonel Fannin, commanding at Goliad, "Sir, on my arrival here this afternoon, the following intelligence was received through a Mexican, supposed to be friendly, though his account has been contradicted in some parts by another who arrived with him. It is therefore only given to you as a rumor, though I fear a melancholy portion of it will be found true. Anselmo Borguera states that he left the Alamo on Sunday the 6th, and is 6 days from Aroche's ranch, that the Alamo was attacked on Sunday morning at the dawn of day by about 2,300 men and carried a short time before sunrise by a loss of 521 Mexicans killed and as many wounded. Colonel Travis had only 150 effective men out of his entire force of 187. After the fort was carried, 7 men surrendered and called for Santa Anna and for quarter. They were murdered by his order. Colonel Bowie was sick in his bed and was also murdered. The enemy expect a reinforcement of 1,500 men under General Corday and a reserve of 1,500 to follow them. He also informs us that Ugarteca had arrived with 2 millions of specie for the payment of the troops. The bodies of the Americans were burned after the massacre. alternate layers of wood and bodies were laid together and set on fire. Lieutenant Dickinson, who had a wife and a child in the fort, after having fought with desperate courage, tied his child to his back and leaped from the top of a two-story building. Both were killed by the fall. I have little doubt but that the Alamo has fallen. Whether the above particulars are all true may be questionable. You are therefore referred to the enclosed order. He added a postscript. In confirmation of the truth of the fall of the Alamo, I have ascertained that Colonel Travis intended firing signal guns at three different periods each day until succor should arrive. No signal guns have been heard since Sunday, though a scouting party have just returned who approached within 12 miles of it and remained there 48 hours. Houston's enclosed order directed Fannin to destroy Fort Defiance, leave Goliad, and relocate to Victoria as soon as practicable on receipt of the order. Fannin received the order on March 14th, but did not act with haste. Instead, he delayed, waiting on the return of several of his men that had gone to the relief of Refugio. He waited in vain because General Urrea had already captured and killed them. He did not set out to follow the orders until March 19, 1836. While Fannin waited at Goliad, at the convention of 1836, Lorenzo de Zavala finished composing the Constitution of the Republic of Texas and set out to create an interim government. Santa Anna, meanwhile, split his forces with the goal of chasing down both Houston and the members of the convention. On March 17, 1836, David G. Burnett became the president of the interim government, with Zavala as its vice president and others filling other key positions. They then fled toward Harrisburg. General Urrea had started towards Goliad from Refugio on March 16th, and his advanced forces drew near to Goliad on March 18th. Fannin and his force set out on March 19th, 1836. It was a foggy morning when Fannin and his troops set out at about 9 a.m. Fannin took too little food and water and too many artillery pieces and muskets to travel swiftly. Delays plagued the unfortunate effort at withdrawal towards Victoria. Fannin had only a two-hour lead and lost it to Urrea and his cavalry. Fannin did not make it to the cover of the timber near Coleto Creek and faced Urrea's soldiers on the open prairie utilizing a defensive square. Fannin's men fought hard, and the battle lasted until sunset. With too little water and unable to light fires that would make them easy targets, Fannin had been wounded himself, and his men found themselves in a bad situation. The wounded were suffering and crying out in the dark. 10 Texans had died. Cold set in with the arrival of a rainy norther. Fannin's men entrenched themselves. The next morning, Urrea began firing his artillery at the trapped Texans. Fannin and his officers decided to seek honorable terms of surrender. The wounded needed much attention. Urrea could not agree to any terms. The Tornell Decree and Santa Anna's orders required death, but Urrea promised to intercede on their behalf with his commander. The surrendering Texans were sent back to Goliad. About 230 uninjured or slightly injured men were marched back immediately. The worse off, including Fannin, were transported over the next 2 days. Urrea sought clemency, but Santa Anna refused. He wrote Urrea the following letter. Office of the Secretary to the President of the Mexican Republic, General-in-Chief of the Army of Operations, General D. Jose Urrea, Bear, March 24, 1836. My dear friend, by means of your official report and personal letter, which I now answer, I've been happily informed of your triumphs over the insolent foreigners that threatened to invade even the interior of the Republic. It is well done, my friend, and continue bringing glory to the nation. Who shall know how to reward you accordingly? I regret that you have made it necessary for me to remind you anew, as I have done in my official communication, of the Supreme Government circular regarding the conduct to be observed with the infamous foreigners that, profaning the sacred territory of the Republic, have been captured with weapons in hand, spilling the blood of the Mexicans. I am surpassed by no one, my friend, in compassion, as I do not know how to hate any man. And in spite of my personal dislikes, I have never thought of revenge. But I do not have the faculties to override a peremptory decision of the supreme government and pardon any delinquents of the magnitude of these foreigners. Under which flag do they wage war on the entire republic, assassinating traitorously our garrisons, burning our towns, attacking the property of peaceful citizens, and intending to steal a great part of our territory? And you prefer that national indignation should fall upon me, as shall be the case if I protect such outlaws? You can well discern that this is not a civil war, as we have unfortunately fought amongst ourselves before. Neither is it a war of nations, in which the rights of man in war deserve mercy, respect to prisoners until they are exchanged. These foreigners, like bandits, have assaulted the territory of the republic to steal a part of it, destroying everything. And because the supreme government is justified in declaring them pirates and ordering that they should be treated and punished as such, there is nothing more to say except that I remain your affectionate friend, Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. Santa Anna ordered Colonel Jose Nicolas de la Portilla to enforce the congressional decree of December 30th, 1835. The, quote, perfidious foreigners must be put to death. No quarter. Fannin and over 300 members of his command were executed on Palm Sunday, March 27th, 1836. Some escaped, and the following account is from one of them. It's from the Republic Pension Application of Andrew A. Boyle. And he wrote, 1 week from the day of capitulation, all the men except the wounded were marched out of the fort in separate divisions, taken a short distance, and shot. A Mexican officer came into the hospital where I was and asked me to tell the men. He wanted all those who were able to walk to come outside. The men commenced gathering up their blankets. In the meantime, four Mexican soldiers came in and commenced carrying out those who were unable to walk. I was assisted out by two comrades who were slightly wounded, having the use of one leg only. I was informed by an officer at the door that we were all going to be shot. On getting outside, I told the men. The wounded lay in the corner of the yard in which the church door fronts. A company of Mexican infantry marched down and formed in front of us. I particularly noticed that they loaded with ball cartridge. A file of men under a corporal took two of our men, marched them out towards the company, bandaged their eyes, made them lay face downwards, pointed muskets to their heads, and shot them. About this time, a Mexican officer, seemingly of distinction, came in amongst us and asked in a loud voice in English if there was any person there by the name of Boyle. I answered, being close by him, leaning against the wall of the hospital on one leg. He told me that he had been looking for me all the morning. He then called a Mexican officer and told him to have me taken to the Mexican officer's hospital to tell the doctor to attend to my wound, and he would be there after a while. On arriving there, the Mexican officers seemed kindly disposed towards me and gave me a pair of armas de pelo to lay on. Mr. Brooks, who was an aide to Colonel Fannin, was laying in the hospital at the time. His leg was badly shattered, close up to the hip. I asked him if he knew what was going on. He told me no. I told him, quote, all our men were shot that morning except the wounded, and they were shooting them then. I told him if he would listen closely, he could hear the screams. He did so and said, I suppose it will be our turn next. In less than 5 minutes, four Mexicans carried him out, caught and all, placed him in the street not 15 feet from the door, and in a position I could not avoid seeing him, and shot him. He was immediately stripped by the soldiers, his gold watch taken, and his body thrown into a pit on the side of the street. A few days after we had been taken prisoners, Colonel Ward and his men were brought into Goliad as prisoners, they having been captured, as we understood, someplace between the Lavaca and Navidad rivers. they were shot with our men. The number of men shot that morning, according to the Mexican report, was 417. John C. Duval also left a recollection of the events. He wrote, "After our surrender, we were marched back to Goliad, escorted by a large detachment of cavalry, and there confined within the walls surrounding the old mission. Among the Mexican officers there was a lieutenant by the name of Martinez, who had been educated at a Catholic college in Kentucky, where he had been a roommate of a member of Captain D's company by the name of B. Every day, whilst we were prisoners, he used to come and talk with B and professed his great regret to find him in such a situation. But he never gave him the slightest intimation of the treacherous designs of the Mexicans, nor, as far as I know, made the least effort to save his college roommate. A day or so after our return as prisoners to Goliad, Major Ward and his battalion, or rather those who survived the engagements they had with the Mexicans near Refugio, were brought in and confined with us within the walls enclosing the old mission, and also a company of about 80 men under the command of Major Miller, who had been surprised and captured at Kilpano just after they had landed from their vessel. These men were also confined with us, but kept separate from the rest, and to distinguish them, each had a white cloth tied around one of his arms. At the time, I had no idea why this was done, but subsequently I learned the reason. The morning of the sixth day after our return to Goliad, whether the Mexicans suspected we intended to rise upon the guard, or whether they merely wished to render our situation uncomfortable as possible, I know not. But at any rate, from that time we were confined in the old mission, where we were so crowded we had hardly room to lie down at night. Our rations, too, about that time had been reduced to 5 ounces of fresh beef a day, which we had to cook in the best way we could and eat without salt. Although thus closely confined and half-starved, no personal indignity was ever offered to us, to my knowledge, except on two occasions. Once a Mexican soldier pricked one of our men with his bayonet because he did not walk quite fast enough to suit him, whereupon he turned and knocked the Mexican down with his fist. I fully expected to see him roughly handled for this overt act, but the officer in command of the guard, who saw the affair, came up to him and, patting him on the shoulder, told him he was muy bravo and that he had served the soldier exactly right. At another time, one of our men was complaining to the officer of the guard of the ration issued to him, who ordered one of the soldiers to collect a quantity of bones and other offal lying around, and throwing them on the ground before the man, said, "There, eat as much as you want, good enough for gringos and heretics." And a little bit farther on, Duval continued, saying, "On the morning of the 27th of March, a Mexican officer came to us and ordered us to get ready for a march. He told us we were to be liberated on parole and that arrangements had been made to send us to New Orleans on board vessels then at Copano. This, you may be sure, was joyful news to us, and we lost no time in making preparations to leave our uncomfortable quarters. When all was ready, we were formed into three divisions and marched out under a strong guard. As we passed by some Mexican women who were standing near the main entrance to the fort, I heard them say, 'Pobrecitos, poor fellows,' but the incident at the time made but little impression on my mind. One of our divisions was taken down the road leading to the lower fort of the river, one upon the road to San Patricio, and the division to which my company was attached along the road leading to San Antonio. A strong guard accompanied us, marching in double files on both sides of our column. It occurred to me that the division of our men into three squads and marching us off into three directions was rather a singular maneuver, but still I had no suspicion of the foul play intended of us. When about half a mile above town, a halt was made, and the guard on the side next to the river filed around to the opposite side. Hardly had this maneuver been executed when I heard a heavy firing of musketry in the directions taken by the other two divisions. Someone near me exclaimed, 'Boys, they're going to shoot us,' and at the same instant I heard the clicking of musket locks all along the Mexican line. I turned to look, and as I did so, the Mexicans fired upon us, killing probably 100 out of the 150 men in the division. We were in double file, and I was in the rear rank. The The man in front of me was shot dead, and in falling, he knocked me down. I did not get up for a moment, and when I rose to my feet, I found that the whole Mexican line had charged over me and were in hot pursuit of those who had not been shot and who were fleeing towards the river about 500 yards distant. I followed on after them, for I knew that escape in any other direction, all open prairie, would be impossible, and I had nearly reached the river before it became necessary to make my way through the Mexican line ahead. As I did so, one of the soldiers charged me with his bayonet, his gun, I suppose, being empty. As he drew his musket back to make a lunge at me, one of our men, coming from another direction, ran between us, and the bayonet was driven through his body. The blow was given with such force that in falling, the man probably wrenched or twisted the bayonet in such a way as to prevent the Mexican from withdrawing it immediately. I saw him put his foot upon the man and make an ineffectual attempt to extricate the bayonet from his body, but one look satisfied me, as I was somewhat in a hurry just then, and I hastened to the bank of the river and plunged in. The river at that point was deep and swift, but not wide, and being a good swimmer, I soon gained the opposite bank, untouched by any of the bullets that were spattering in the water around my head. But here, I met with an unexpected difficulty. The bank on that side was so steep I found it impossible to climb up, and I continued to swim down the river until I came to where a grapevine hung from the bough of a leaning tree nearly to the surface of the water. This I caught hold of and was climbing up it hand over hand, sailor fashion, when a Mexican on the opposite bank fired at me with his escopeta, and with so true an aim that he cut the vine in two just above my head, and down I came into the water again. I then swam on about 100 yards further, when I came to a place where the bank was not quite so steep, and with some difficulty I managed to clamber up. The river on the north side was bordered by timber several 100 yards in width, through which I quickly passed, and I was just about to leave it and strike out into the open prairie when I discovered a party of lancers nearly in front of me, sitting on their horses and evidently stationed there to intercept anyone who should attempt to escape in that direction. I halted at once under cover of the timber, through which I could see the lancers in the open prairie, but which hid me entirely from their view. Whilst I was thus waiting and undecided as to the best course to pursue under the circumstances, I saw a young man by the name of Holliday, one of my own messmates, passing through the timber above me in a course that would have taken him out at the point directly opposite to which the lancers were stationed. I called to him as loudly as I dared, and fortunately, being on the qui vive, he heard me and stopped far enough within the timber to prevent the lancers from discovering him. I then pulled off a fur cap I had on and beckoned to him with it. This finally drew his attention to me, and soon as he saw me, he came to where I was standing, from whence, without being visible to them, the lancers could be plainly seen. He then goes on and explains how he finally made his escape, and then closes this part of it with the end result that Colonel Fannin faced. And he wrote, "Colonel Fannin, who was confined to his quarters by a wound he had received at the fight on the Coleto, soon after the massacre of his men, was notified to prepare for immediate execution. He merely observed that he was ready then, as he had no desire to live after the cold-blooded, cowardly murder of his men. He was thereupon taken out to the square by a guard, where he was seated on a bench and his eyes blindfolded. A moment before the order to fire was given, I was told, though I cannot vouch for the truth of the statement, he drew a fine gold watch from his pocket and, handing it to the officer in command of the guard, requested him as a last favor to order his men to shoot him in the breast and not in the head. The officer took the watch and immediately ordered the guard to fire at his head. Colonel Fannin fell dead, and his body was thrown into one of the ravines near the fort. Thus died as brave a son of Georgia as ever came from that noble old state." Portilla, the man charged by Santa Anna to enforce the terms of the Tournell Decree, wrote this in his journal: "At daybreak, I came to a determination to execute the orders of His Excellency, the Commander-in-Chief, considering him as the superior I ought to obey. I gave orders for the whole garrison to form and awaken the prisoners, 445 in number, who were still asleep. I ordered 80 of the class who had come from Copano to be separated from the rest, inasmuch as their fate demanded consideration, because, when invading our territory, they were taken without arms in their hands. We formed ourselves into three divisions, the first under the orders of the first adjutant, Don Agustin Alcerica, the second under those of Captain Luis Balderas, and the third of Captain Antonio Ramirez. To these officers I entrusted the execution of the order of the commander-in-chief. It was executed. A great struggle of feelings among the officers and soldiers. A profound silence. Sad at heart, I wrote to General Urrea, expressing my regret at having been concerned in so painful an affair. I also sent an official account of what I had done to the general-in-chief. And the following is what Portillo wrote to the General Urrea after the events of March 27, 1836. And he wrote, "I feel much distressed at what has occurred here. A scene enacted in cold blood having passed before my eyes, which has filled me with horror. All I can say is that my duty as a soldier and what I owe to my country must be my guarantee. My dear General, by you was I sent here. You thought proper to do so, and I remain here in conformity to your wishes. I came, as you know, voluntarily with these poor Indians to cooperate to the best of my humble means for my country's good. No man is required to do more than is within the scope of his abilities, and both they and myself have doubtless been placed here as competent to the purposes you had in view. I repeat it, that I am perfectly willing to do anything, save and accepting the work of a public executioner, by receiving orders to put more persons to death. And yet, being but a subordinate officer, it is my duty to do what is commanded me, even though repugnant to my feelings. I am, General, your devoted and sincere friend, J.N. de la Portilla." Upon hearing of the massacre and the fate of Fannin, Sam Houston correctly surmised that Fannin had tried to retreat in daylight in the face of superior force. And of Fannin specifically, Houston added, "He is an ill-fated man." The news of the deaths at the Alamo and at Goliad sent Texans, rightfully so, into a panic and launched what is known as the Runaway Scrape. It also enraged the men under Sam Houston's command. Santa Anna had demanded blood, justified by law. The Texian army demanded the same in retribution. After the success of taking Bear in December 1835, the tide had turned against rebellious and bilious Texans. At least 182 had died at the Alamo. At least another 7 had been killed at Agua Dulce in San Patricio. About 28 had been killed with Captain King at Refugio, with Mexican losses at an estimated 150 wounded. At Coleto Creek, an estimated 10 Texians had been killed, and anywhere from 60 to 80 had been severely wounded, including Fannin. And Fannin's total force numbered about 305. About 50 Mexican soldiers had died in the fighting, with about 140 wounded out of Urrea's total force of about 1,400. And on the day of the Goliad massacre, somewhere between 342 and 354 Texians were slain, and about 28 men, a couple of whom we've heard from here today, escaped, and some were spared, including about 80 of Miller's men that had not been caught taking up arms.
You are listening to Texas History Lessons, a slow walk through Texas history made in Texas by a Texan for everyone everywhere.
The Alamo resounds in memory and myth. Goliad whispers from the shadows. These are the words printed on the back of my copy of John Willingham's excellent fact-based novel of the Texas Revolution, The Edge of Freedom. A short line that he wrote, and it is profound and speaks volumes. I'd wager that most of you would be hard-pressed to find somebody today unfamiliar with the phrase, "Remember the Alamo." I'd also wager that a poll would show that significantly more people are familiar with those words than another phrase that was also roared on the battlefield of San Jacinto, "Remember Goliad." Most of you listening right now recognize it, and most of you probably could give a good explanation as to why Goliad should be remembered. And I'm not a gambler, but I believe it's a pretty safe bet that most Texans today have only a vague knowledge of its significance. Now, I'm not going to venture into speculation now as to why that isn't the case, but I do want to take a moment to review why Remember Goliad was just as meaningful in 1836 as Remember the Alamo. The deaths there convinced the American public to get behind the war efforts of the Texans. Had the soldiers captured just been sent to New Orleans, as they had been told, some of them had been told, then it would have been a different reaction. It would have looked more possibly like it was a failed cause. But what happened did happen, and it enraged many. In The Edge of Freedom, John Willingham tells the story of James W. Fannin, his counterpart Jose de Urrea, and the search for peace at Goliad that was as dramatic as the fight for glory at the Alamo. And I encourage you to go get a copy of it and read it. And in the foreword to his novel, Willingham wrote, "With the story of the Goliad campaign, we find almost no uncomplicated truths, real or imagined. The story is more resonant with our own confounding times than with what we think of as the past. We know that Colonel James Fannin received an urgent request to march to the relief of the Alamo, delivered by James Bonham. But we do not know exactly what Bonham said or how Fannin replied. And likewise, we do not know all of the reasons for Fannin's subsequent reactions. And there are many more questions about the events near Goliad 175 years ago. The Goliad story is not so often remembered as the dramatic battle of the Alamo. But in some ways, Goliad is more present. Ambiguity, compromise, frustrated goodwill, hovering dangers, all of these characteristic of our own time and our own lives." I'm going to close with this last statement, that leading up to the release of this episode, I announced that it would be on the massacre at Goliad. And somebody that I'm sure they thought they were a well-meaning person questioned the use of the word massacre. And I suggested execution might appease them as being proper. They replied that punishment for filibusters was accurate and just. And even today, there are people that celebrate Goliad as punishment for filibusters and pirates. But I still think massacre is appropriate, and from some of the words I've shared by some of the Mexican officers, I think that many of the men that were involved with perpetrating the massacre would agree that that's just what it was, whether it was justified by law or not. Well, that's going to do it. We'll be taking a look at the runaway scrape soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Derek McLennan for providing the theme music. Take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Be kind. Adios.